Out of the circle is by appealing to considerations which lie outside the speaker's consciousness, to which he himself does not appeal, he only doing what comes now naturally to him. So I'm treating the paradox of investigation dependence as a kind of despairing development of classical realism. That's to say, we look for an independently identifiable explanation of the speaker's verdict on the next case, and we get the satisfaction of the theory of universals. So, we turn to the speaker's past applications of the word, but are disappointed to discover that they can be interpreted in many different ways. Well, it seems then that meaning has no identifiable basis. And then, of course, the question is, if that is so, how can truth stand firm? The very idea of semantic normativity seems to evaporate. Well, I don't think there's any quick remedy to that form of skepticism about meaning. But the first and most important step towards answering it is, I think, to locate meaning in the speaker's technique, and to find the identity and justification of his technique, not in anything restricted to the particular moment when he deploys it, when he uses it, but in what it achieves in the long run. The survival of the technique is, to put it in one word, Darwinian. This way of circumventing the paradox of investigation dependence is, of course, holistic rather than atomistic. What favours the survival of a particular linguistic technique is something which accrues in the long term rather than a particular item detectable on the occasion of its use. And that, of course, is one aspect of the enormous difference between language and any other exhibition of skill to which people may achieve. In the other cases, nobody worries that the incompleteness of an explanation which takes meaning for granted. In this case, we do worry, and we find no explanation within the sequence of the person's behaviour, and we are therefore forced to move outside, either to the possibility of communicating with other people, or to the possibility of discovering regularities in nature by using the technique. And well, that's all I want to say about that. And the important point I'm starting from now is that the meaningfulness of language does depend on what I've been calling syncopation, that is, the fusing of two things, which in all other cases are separate, and we expect them to be separate in this case, but they're not separate. Hence the mystery of meaning. So I could say more about that, but I'll leave that point. And now I want to move on to having a drink. I should say, with emphasis, that I'm not taking any particular view about Wittgenstein's doctrine of showing in the Tractatus. I think myself the only way to answer the question, what did he mean by the last two pages of the Tractatus, is to read on in the years 29 to 35, when he goes back to philosophy, and you can see how he develops his early ideas in the Tractatus. I mean, in other words, I'm inclined to think that the only account that fits what happened is a gradualistic account and not a sudden account. I mean, so it might be a bit different from yours. But I don't want to go into that. What does seem to me indisputable is that all the basic and important questions in philosophical investigations come out of the area left by the gradual abandonment of the doctrine of Schelling in the Tractatus. I regard it as gradual, not sudden. Right, well, now the next thing I want to do is, I can be brief about, I want to talk about the target of the private language argument. And here I think it's fairly clear what the target is. And I want to say something about that and connect it up with what I've just been saying about the technique of speaking a language being the ultimate repository of meaning rather than any formulation. What is the private language argument directed against? Well, here I think it's fairly clear what's happening. Wittgenstein, of course, means by private language one which is necessarily unteachable. He says that very clearly at the beginning of the discussion. And his claim is that the would-be speaker of such a language, a necessarily unteachable one, could never set up, never set it up to record his own sensations privately. And that, of course, is obviously a strong concept of privacy, much more extreme than a locked diary or a coded message, which is considerably uncodable or unlockable. But this is necessarily indecipherable. Well, this critique first appears in the discussion of sensation language in 1936 in Notes the lectures on private experience and sense data. And then it's developed in philosophical investigations, of course. That's where we normally read about it. And it's reviewed in the less well-known 1941 British Academy lecture, the lecture which Wittgenstein never gave, which is reprinted in a book called Philosophical Occasions, I think, edited by Nordstrom. Now, the fact that the answer to the question about the identity of the target is given very clearly in Investigations 272-3, which I'll read. He says, the essential thing about private experience is really not that each person possesses his own exemplar, but that nobody knows whether other people also have this or something else. The assumption that would be possible, though unverifiable, but one section of mankind had one sensation of red, and another section another. What am I to say about the word red? That it means something confronting us all, and that everyone should really have another word besides this one to mean his own sensation of red. Or is it really like this? The word red means something known to everyone, and in addition to each person, it means something known only to him, or perhaps rather it refers to something only to him. Well, he is mocking the version of the theory that Carnap had developed in the Illusion of Belt in 1928. Carnap's idea was that sensations are bracketed between stimuli and responses, physical responses, and each of us really speaks two languages, although we don't know it. One specifies the stimuli and responses in physical terms, and the other specifies the sensations themselves in sensory terms. It's easy to understand how we communicate with one another. We communicate in the first of these two languages. But the second one is private in the strong sense of a word investigated by Wittgenstein. Well, there's a more sympathetic treatment of this theory found earlier in Philosophical Remarks. It's a well-known passage. It's how it goes. We could represent the following way of, sorry, we could adopt the following way of representing matters. If I, LW, have toothache, then that's expressed by means of a proposition, there is toothache. But if that is so, what we now express by the proposition A has toothache is put as follows. A is behaving as LW behaves when he has toothache. Similarly, we should say it is thinking, and A is behaving as LW does when it is thinking. It's evident that this way of speaking is equivalent to ours when it comes to questions of intelligibility and freedom from ambiguity. But it's equally clear that this language could have anyone at all as its centre. And that is followed by a discussion of some of the details of the theory about the two levels of language, one specifying stimuli and responses, and the other specifying the sensations which they bracket. The difficulty which threatens the theory is that there's nothing to guarantee the identity of a sensation type of A is specified in B's indirect way with a sensation type of A is specified in his own more intimate way. So it seems that people can communicate with one another about their sensations only in the indirect way. Right, now that's not a new difficulty. It's been pointed out by Russell in Philosophy of Logical Atomism. Russell accepted the difficulty as inevitable and just left it at that in typical Russellian fashion. But of course, it raises a difficult question. What is the role of the sensations themselves? What do they do? And Wittgenstein's answer to that question was that they don't have any role at all if they're treated as independent inner objects. And so, since they obviously do have a role, they must be treated in some other way. That's the position he reached in 1936. But in his earlier text, he had not yet reached that point because he had not yet formulated his argument against the possibility of a private language. Now, evidently, what puts a private language in jeopardy is the lack of one of the two resources which I have been talking about, communication with other people, or the ability to discover regularities in the natural world around us. If there were any natural regularities on which this would-be speaker of private language could rely, they could only be regular connections between his own sensations. Because, according to this theory, in the original position, this world is purely phenomenal. But of course, it's questionable whether it's possible to use purely phenomenal connections to set up a language. Now, this identification of the target of the private language is confirmed by what he says in the later lecture, in which he reviewed the private language argument, the 1941 Ungiven lecture. Sensory foundationalism starts by detaching the inner world of sensations from the outer physical world, and then tries to compensate for the loss of solidity by crediting sensations with the very kind of independence and substantiality that properly belongs to physical objects. Barclay's philosophy of perception is a paradigm, of course, of this treatment. Next step is then taken by phenomenalists. Sensations are not just a substitute for physical objects, they are what physical objects boil down to. Now this focus on a single identifiable target underlies Wittgenstein's treatment, but there's less agreement on how the treatment itself goes. The discussion in Investigations, and also the previous discussion in the 1936 lecture, is very long and complicated, and necessarily so, because the connections between the inner world and the outer world are of very many, very different kinds. Pain, for example, has a natural expression in behavior, but the impression of color, for example, it has much more complex links with the physical world, and it does not have the kind of simple expressive relations pain has. That is all I want to say about the identification of the target. And now I want to... I'm sorry, this is a chaotic paper. I want to go back. I want to discuss a recent controversy between me and Barry Stroud about the use of the word criterion in relation to Wittgenstein's private language argument. And I want to explore the possibility that in the case of sensation language, there is a kind of syncopation, to use the term I used earlier, parallel or related to the syncopation which you get in any attempt to explain correctness in the use of language. So I now change the subject. Barry Stroud, in his critique of my book, The False Prism, rejects my suggestion that Wittgenstein argued that the would-be speaker of a private language would have no reliable criterion of truth, as what I suggested. He thinks that the context of Investigations 258 makes it perfectly clear that Wittgenstein's point is not what I say it was, but his point was that the words in his sensory vocabulary would have no determinate meanings. That would be a more radical handicap. In an ordinary case of intentional action, the agent needs to know two things. One, what he is engaged in doing, and two, that he is succeeding in doing that thing, if indeed he is. On Stroud's interpretation, the would-be speaker of a private language would lack the first of those two kinds of knowledge, while on the interpretation which I suggested in my book, he would lack the second kind. And the question is, which of us is right? And also, how is this controversy related to the more general controversy about the criterion of meaningfulness in any factual language, the thing I started with? Okay. Sorry, are you with me? I have a sort of feeling that I'm wandering off into some intellectual vacuum entirely on my own. But is it? Well, that's the nature of this subject. It's the subject for solitary exploration. And when you come back and report where you've been, you talk to somebody else about it, you find that they've been exploring the same subject, but they haven't been anywhere near where you have been. It's very difficult to bring things together. But that's just the essence of this particular subject. I'm sure you'll recognize the experience. If you ever talk to somebody else about what they think about Wittgenstein's views, you find verbal agreement, but substantial total disagreement underneath. And that's a very curious phenomenon. It's related... I'm wondering. Anyway, Stroud and me, this is my book, and Stroud's article in my first trip, not in the book. Well, the evidence cited by Stroud in defense of his interpretation is impressive. He points out that in 258, I won't read it, you must know all this. I mean, I'm assuming you know the Investigations by heart now. He points out that in section 258, Wittgenstein starts with the question how the meaning of a word in a private language will be fixed. And he makes the would-be speaker of the language answer that it will be fixed by ostensive definition. Now, that's important that the man gives that answer. And Stroud's objection to this answer, Wittgenstein's objection, is that an ostensive definition would leave the subsequent application of the word entirely open. In other words, ostensive definitions by themselves are essentially impotent. So the speaker would not know what he was engaged in doing when he applied the word. He'd lack the first kind of knowledge, which is required by any intentional action. Now, this is clearly a difficulty about meaning rather than a difficulty about truth. And the point is reinforced by the context of 258. In 257, Wittgenstein discusses the case of a child living in a world in which people showed no automatic outward signs of pain. There are people like that, of course, you know. The stimuli are not mentioned in this discussion. Wittgenstein says if he were a genius, could he not simply name his own pain? Perhaps he could go through the ceremony of naming it, Wittgenstein says, but his ostensive definition would leave the subsequent application of the name indeterminate. And later, in sections 259 to 264, Wittgenstein develops his own thesis that ostensive definitions used in isolation are never sufficient to fix the meanings of words. And this thesis, of course, is defended very early on in Investigations, in sections 28 to 31. And here, what Wittgenstein here, in the Critique of Private Language, is applying the point to the special case of sensations. Now, I think that evidence, I agree with Stroud, is sufficient to establish the positive part of his interpretation. Wittgenstein's rejection of private language, whatever else it may involve, is at least based on the contention that in such a language, meanings could be neither fixed nor preserved. However, this evidence is not sufficient to establish the negative part of his thesis, which is that Wittgenstein's rejection of the private language argument has nothing to do with the criteria of truth. So I now want to explore the possibility that the two interpretations can be combined. And the possibility that we should take this criticism of the private language to be that it could not accommodate either meaning or truth. But of course, there are several objections to this. First, Stroud has an argument in his paper which could be used against this dual interpretation. The argument is that if there's no determinate meaning, the question of truth simply arises. True, but against this, we can still ask whether truth would have been attainable if there had been determinate meanings. So of course, our interest here is theoretical rather than practical, and we really want to know everything that's wrong with the hypothesis that there might be a private language. Second, it's worth observing that it was Carnap who maintained that the meanings of words in the pioneer's sensory vocabulary would be fixed by ostensive definition. And that is why Wittgenstein concentrated his attack on that particular method. That confirms my identification of the target of Wittgenstein's private language argument, but at the same time it points to a difficulty in Stroud's interpretation. Carnap did in fact rely on isolated ostensive definitions, and that of course makes him vulnerable to the criticism developed by Wittgenstein in 256 to 259, interpreted in Stroud's way. But presumably Wittgenstein was not just presenting an ad hominem argument, and I think he must have believed that there was some feature of sensations which would have made it impossible for Carnap to improve his theory by appealing to the speaker's application of the ostensibly defined word to further sensations in order to fix it. But what feature of sensations would have made that improvement impossible? I think Stroud's interpretation remains incomplete until that feature has been identified. I'll return to that point later, and I'll argue that the impediment that makes it impossible for a private language to accommodate meaning is the same as the impediment that makes it impossible for it to accommodate truth. It's uncertainty about the application of a word. And this will need to be defended against the obvious objection that uncertainty is possible only after meaning has been fixed. But the defense is not difficult. The transition from establishing the meaning to making true statements with that meaning is, of course, a gradual one, and the two functions overlap in real life. There is also a third difficulty raised by Stroud's interpretation. There's really quite strong evidence for the other interpretation, which takes Wittgenstein to be concerned in aids with truth rather than meaning. This, of course, would not be a difficulty for Stroud's interpretation if it were combined with its rival. It's a difficulty only when it's offered as an interpretation which excludes its rival. And the main evidence for the rival is, in fact, 258 itself. where Wittgenstein says, but in the present case, I have no criterion of correctness. One would like to say, whatever is going to seem right to me is right. And that only means that here we cannot talk about right. That's 2.8. But in 5.80, he says that an inner process stands in need of outer criteria. Well, here I think it's natural to take the word criterion to apply to a feature of the sensations to which the would-be private linguist considers applying the word. And this is the objective use of the word criterion. It simply signifies a mark by which object is recognized in the primary use. So it looks as if that is what the would-be private linguist lacks when he's trying to apply his sensory word to his sensations. True, we can also say that someone lacks a criterion when he has no knowledge of a mark. It's a different point. No knowledge of a mark by which to recognize a type of object. But that would be, of course, a secondary or subjective use of the word criterion. So the evidence here seems to support a combination of the two interpretations. The hypothesis that a private language can accommodate neither meaning nor truth. But there's still an objection, an obstacle to this compromise. Wittgenstein's combination of the two criticisms, if that's what he's doing, under the heading lack of criterion, really is strange, and it needs to be explained in a way which will make it fully intelligible. He can hardly be playing on the ambiguity between objectivity and subjectivity, which is the word criterion. And he must have had a deeper reason for fusing the two criticisms. So my next question is, how can the fusion of the two aspects of criterion be explained? How am I doing for time? How much time have I got left?
What?
20 minutes, you say? 10 minutes, well, I'll try. I'm sorry, I said this is a rambling paper. This is a paper that got deconstructed as I was constructing it. And so it has no, well, I don't want to be unfair to it, but it hasn't got as much form structure as a paper usually has. I'm sorry about that. So the next question, which brings me back to what I was discussing at the beginning of this paper, how can the fusion of the two aspects of the word criteria be explained? And I want to bring it back to what I was discussing in the first 10 minutes, which is what I was calling syncopation, right? Where the criteria of meaning and the criteria of the truth get fused in the general discussion of the essential nature of language. Now, the answer to my question, how could the fusion of the two senses of criterion be explained? I mean, not their existence, but the fact that Wittgenstein slips from one to the other and back again. That's what has to be explained. The way I would try to explain it, and I better confess at the moment that this paper ends inconclusively. The way I try to explain it is by relating it to the question of the syncopation of the criteria for using a word regularly and the truth of a particular use of the word and the inability to find anything outside except general considerations about the nature of language. So that's what I'm trying to do next. The point here is that there's in general a difference between knowing a mark by which you recognize a type of object and being able to recognize that mark when you see it. It's two different things. For example, I may know that creature is a whale if it has a horizontal tail, but of course I may be short-sighted and cannot tell whether its tail is vertical or horizontal. Two different failures. But though that difference is very clear in the case of physical objects, it's not so clear in the case of types of sensation. In fact, there seems to be no room for a parallel distinction in a typical case like pain. For in such a case, the original criteria was And when the sufferer has already mastered the concept, he doesn't need to apply the physical criteria to himself. He can just tell that he's in pain, to use Elizabeth Anscombe's formulation. He can just tell immediately. So the distinction that is so clear in the case of physical objects, the distinction between knowing the mark and knowing that this is the mark in a particular case, this distinction is fused in the case of sensations. You learn a technique for discriminating a type of sensation, but you don't learn to recognize any mark of that type. Because once you've internalized the technique, you know immediately whether you are in pain or not, or whatever. At this point, it's made very clearly in section 288 of Investigations, and I'll read it. If I now say, for example, oh, I know what pain means, what I don't know is whether this, which I now have, is pain. Somebody has said that we merely shake our heads, we're forced to regard his words as a queer reaction. We have no idea what to do with it. The expression of doubt has no place in the language game. But if we cut out human behavior, which is the expression of sensation, it looks as if I might legitimately begin to doubt afresh. That is, if you cut out the behavior, it looks as if the sensation is a kind of internal object about whose nature you might wonder, is this really pain? Sorry, back to the My temptation to say that one might take a sensation for something other than it is arises in the following way. If I assume the abrogation of the normal language game with the expression of a sensation, then I need a criterion of identity for the sensation, and then the possibility of error also exists. At this point lies at the heart of Wittgenstein's treatment of sensation language. What makes it so hard to keep it steadily in mind is the fact that speaking a language is something we do intentionally. For in typical cases of intentional action, the agent has a plan. For example, with a fax machine, his plan is to press the play button. But because he's short-sighted, he presses the button, not delete. It's a way of simplifying your life. He knows what he's engaged in doing, but he does not know that he's actually failing to do it. Now, this combination of knowledge with ignorance is very easy to understand because there are two clearly distinguishable steps in his internal monitoring of his performance. But if someone makes a mistake in applying a word to a sensation, the situation has an entirely different structure. He does not misapply the criteria that were used when he was first taught the meaning of the word. He simply deviates from the technique which he has appeared to have internalized. In many cases, the technique is so simple that it's hard to see how you can make such a mistake. And this receives its philosophical exaggeration in the theory that all sensory statements are incorrigible. Evidently, Wittgenstein did believe that to be true of pain, but we don't have to suppose that he generalized it to all sensory statements. It's easier to miss the point of this account of the difference between sensory language and the language used to describe physical objects. And there are, in fact, two misunderstandings that need to be forestalled. First, he's often taken to be making the point that sensations can only be expressed and never described. But that's a misunderstanding against which he guarded later. There's a discussion in remarks on the foundation of psychology in which he makes it very clear that there is such a thing as describing a sensation. If you felt it needed clear, what do you do when your doctor asks you about some mysterious internal pain? You don't say, wait a minute, and express it. Obviously, there are techniques for non-descriptive pain. Wittgenstein wasn't denying it. Secondly, sometimes credited with the view that sensory language can only be taught by way of a pupil's natural expression of his pain. And this, too, is a mistake. I mean, in sections 244 to 5, Wittgenstein remarks that a child can be taught the meaning of the word pain by being told to substitute it for his natural expression of pain. But there's no suggestion whatsoever that this is express my problem. It's absurdity. However, it must be admitted that Wittgenstein hates very close to the thesis the sensory language would be unteachable if there were no natural ways of expressing it. A revealing example is his treatment of the question, what would it be like if human beings showed no outward signs of pain, did not groan, grimace, etc., if in Putnam's words they were super stoics. Now, many pains are caused by identifiable stimuli, which the sufferer can learn to avoid. But this important fact is not mentioned at this point in investigations. Instead, Wittgenstein says the answer is, but it would be impossible to teach a child the use of the word toothache. I'm quoting him. Now, it's true that this is put in inverted commas, and one of the problems with the investigation is to know who's speaking, and there are passages where the translation reverses the role of Wittgenstein and interlocutor. And I think, in this case, I think it's extremely important that he's giving, in quotations, a common answer, but not subscribing to it. I'm sorry, I'm going on too long. I think perhaps it's about time I ended. But really, there is no determinants to this paper. The thing I want to really, at this point, suggest is this, that this particular syncopation of the two ways in which a sensation statement might be false. There are not two ways. It's not like the falsity of a statement about a material object. I want to simply say at this point that there's a certain analogy between that syncopation and the one which I began by discussing when I was talking about the general problem of factual language. But the relation is not identity, but they're in the same field. And really, I'm trying to develop in this paper the suggestion that his treatment of sensation language is a detailed analysis of the same kind of thing, a similar kind of thing, to his treatment of general treatment of factual language. That's to say, what you get throughout this treatment is what I've been calling syncopation, which is the fusing of two aspects of what's going on, which is forgotten by those of us who treat sensation language as if it was just another rather more inaccessible, evanescent kind of material object language. But I'm sorry, I haven't really made my case, but I knew I was prepared to make it.
You seem to concede that point, if I feel that that was incomplete as a description of what's at issue here. And it was at that point that my mind started to melt a bit. And it seemed like what you wanted to say was something like, well, okay, that's fine, but there should also be something about the nature of sensations itself that comes into an account. And so it almost seemed like you're asking us to grant the following counterfactual, which is, say ostensive definition were a sufficiently rich resource to determine meaning here. In that case, if we were trying to use that resource to name sensations, is there a further reason why the attempt would fail? And I found that my mind simply couldn't grasp what counterfactual it was I was being asked to frame there. Or to put it more generally, there was a moment where you phrased the issue more generally, saying, well, granted the conditions for achieving determinate meaningfulness aren't satisfied here, but say they were, could we then nonetheless see what we have as sufficient to determine truth? And I simply found I couldn't grasp the counterfactual that I needed to pass through in order to be drawn into the rest of the exploration. So I just felt my mind was sort of freezing up at that point.
This is my discussion of the objection, but ostensive definitions pinpointed onto a particular item, whether physical object or sensation, are necessarily incomplete. Yeah.
Well, necessarily incomplete seems too weak. I mean, one point seemed to be something.
Well,
we simply haven't got a coherent conception. Yeah. We haven't got a coherent conception of what we're doing. If we had a halfway coherent conception, then we might see what it would be to complete it. But as I understood Stroud's point as you reported it, the private linguist in 258's attempt to confer meaning isn't just incomplete. It's in worse shape than that. And we seem to need to be able to see it as merely incomplete in order to be able to then have recourse to some feature of sensation as a further contribution to it.
Well, I think my idea was that an isolated ostensive definition is inscrutable, incomplete, without a continuation. And that objection to the self-sufficiency of ostensive definition applies not only to physical objects, but equally to sensation.
Yes.
Consequently, anybody who wanted to argue that that incompleteness was used by Wittgenstein as a knockdown objection to the possibility of using ostensive definition as the foundation of a private language. Anybody who thought that you wanted to use that argument would ask him to say more about the impossibility of completing it. I mean, you know, if I define the color white by this, want to know what my word white means. Of course, I have to produce other examples of white things, and also importantly, things which are not. And all I was saying there was that the simple appeal to ostensive definition by Carnap, unsupplemented, was not really a very strong, was not really open to a very strong objection. In order to complete the objection, you have to say why he couldn't have said that the kind of completion that you have for physical object words, you have to say why that was impossible for sensation words. That was all I was saying. Simply that objection, well, using a single sensation is not enough, is only the beginning of an objection, because that also applies to physical objects. I'm only making a very simple point, and I'm not quite sure whether you're saying it's really too simple to be worth making, or it's mistaken, or perhaps I misunderstood you.
Well, I'm not sure I did understand what you were saying at that point, but it's that once you have a story in which you see that you sensation terms in this way, the way the private linguist wants to. Then I become quite puzzled about what's left to do in an inquiry that it's a parallel issue about rule following. Too.
Yeah.
I mean, I see kind of, I have trouble seeing why there's a further issue that goes through some counterfactual form. But if you could, there would still be a remaining question about your being able to speak truthfully or achieve truth in such performances. And it seemed to me a parallel issue arose about the private linguist case. But if that's a distraction, we can put it aside. It was more this general counterfactual of, yes, there's a problem about achieving meaningfulness in such performances, but that's only half the story. The way we can see is half the story is if we assume that we could, there would still be a remaining problem. It was that we couldn't grasp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that really all I was saying at that point was that the argument against ostensive definition applied to sensations is in itself incomplete. And therefore, if you want to complete it, you have to add that I don't.
May I say something about that? I think when you say that the argument is incomplete, I think you're saying that it has not yet been proven or established that the private language is impossible. When this point about ostensive definition of sensations has been made. And I think I don't disagree with that, but I doubt whether there is to be found in Wittgenstein, Wittgenstein, or anywhere else, a proof or an attempted proof of the impossibility of a private language of the kind you are talking about. I would say that this would-be speaker in 258 has not managed to give so many sense to the word that he's supposed to be introducing. It can't be a word for a sensation, because sensations are expressible in behavior. So whatever the referent of the alleged term that he's introduced is going to be, it can't be a sensation. It can't be something that falls under our concept of sensation. That's how I see the argument going. So now he has to say something else about how, what grammar, so to speak, he's given to that ostensibly defined word. And that's why I think Wittgenstein goes on in 261 to say, well, you can't even say, well, he has something, because has and something are also words of our everyday language. So I see it as he just runs out of things to say, to explain what the meaning of the grammar of this ostensibly defined word is. Now, in a way, that may be answering the question you're pressing by asking what feature of sentences is it that makes it impossible for there to be a private language. The answer would be the fact that sensations are expressed in behavior. But that doesn't, so far, give us a further step in some proof of the impossibility of a private language of sensations. I think it just shows that whatever the referent, the putative reference of this private, the ostensibly defined word is, it can't be sensations.
This, I agree.
Could I ask you another question about the earlier part of your paper? Because I think this is connected to what I'm about to say next, next talk. This idea that you expressed by saying the speaker's technique, a speaker's technique is the repository of meaning. Now that seems right to me, but I don't think that I'm understanding it in the way that you are, since I think that what you are seeking is this right? Something to be found in the speaker's technique which will explain how language is possible or meaning is possible. And that would suggest, because of the problem of what you call syncopation, that the speaker's technique in order to have this explanatory role must be describable in some independent way, some way independently of ascribing knowledge of meaning and so on to the speaker. Is that how you are understanding it? And is description of the speaker's technique that's independent in that sense, what's the only thing that would be needed to, that would give an explanation of the notion of meaning or correctness of language?
Yeah, well, my idea was that any formulation of the technique should be challenged as to whether it was the formulation being used, and that the technique itself unformulated, that of course the source of many descriptions of what the person is doing is that which is the core, the center of the meaning, rather than any kind of formula. That was my idea. And I think that one's forced to some such conclusion, but by the fact that you don't have the material for identifying the technique which the speaker's using in a way which is independent of what he's doing. And therefore, the kind of formulation which leads to, well, the paradox of investigation dependence is really moving in the wrong direction. What it's trying to do is to treat the thing which actually carries the meaning, which is a human technique shared between people, and is trying to formulate it in a way which will make it perfectly clear what it is. And then, of course, it's open to obvious objections used by Wittgenstein. The man goes on in a different way.
I think this is related. Now, as you said, second nature. So there's that sense, and I think that's obviously right. There's another force of the word have to, namely that it's now somehow legitimate for him to speak the way he's doing, and that legitimacy lies in the technique. Now, there are two very, very different notions. The blind notion, namely that he just doesn't, and the other one that somehow a right has been bestowed upon him, or entitlement, and so on. I can't tell whether you're building in the notion of entitlement.
I'm wondering, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll speak more slowly. When you say that the person doesn't have to go back to the technique, he doesn't say, oh, here's my technique, this is what I'm supposed to say. He speaks spontaneously. He knows how to manage. All right, that's true. He doesn't reflect upon his technique, it lies in the background. That's right. On the other hand, when you say have to, you might mean something stronger. Given this technique, he has an entitlement, right? Somehow it is some level of justification or a warrant or something like that. Now, that's a very different notion. And I'm wondering whether which way you meant to have to, just simply as a descriptive fact, he just goes on, or that the technique is the source of the entitlement to something. And I can't tell what you mean on this.
Is what you're saying that the appeal to a technique without specifying what the technique is explains nothing, really? Mm-hmm. Is that?
That's part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure it explains nothing. It could be, but the explanation is something which can't be put, formulated in the ordinary scientific terms that you expect. But it is a mysterious fact, but certain techniques
are achievable by people and can be shared between them, and that those techniques are the foundation of meaningfulness. I mean, it's only when you assume that they could only do that if they could be identified and set out in a formula that you're in trouble. That's just my suggestion. And I guess that's coherent, even if debatable.
I also have a question about the technique. You said that the justification of the technique is something we had to worry about because its survival was Darwinian. It's what it gets you in the long run. And I'm wondering if, in some important sense, this doesn't make the question of the technique. The technique has survival, Darwinian survival value, gets you what it gets you in the long run, only if, in some sense, it works. And it can only work if the technique works the same way for me and for you, and we share the technique. But how do we ever know that we share the technique? Right? Don't we have to establish first that we do share the technique before we can guarantee that the technique is working? So just to give a simple example, by presently, you mean something different as a British speaker than I mean as a North American speaker. And if we were alone in the world, we might not realize that we're actually not sharing the technique. We could think we're communicating. I would say, you say to me, I'll be there presently, and I just think, you always lie, you're always late. In fact, you always tell the truth, you were there in a little while. I was expecting you right now. So the technique, in fact, is not working. We think we share a technique, but we don't. It's not working. And why isn't it working? Well, because I know it's not working because I can specify in advance that we're actually meaning different side of the word. But it might seem to us that the technique is working, and you think we don't have to justify it, but it seems to me that we would be wrong that the technique is working.
So you're suggesting that if the technique is unspecified, then there's no way of deciding whether or not two people are using the same technique.
Well, I don't mean to suggest that we have to have the formula. You rejected the idea that we needed to have a formulaic version of it. So maybe we don't need to formulate it. But there has to be a fact of the matter what the technique is, whether we can formulate the fact of the matter or not. Perhaps the only way for there to be a fact of the matter is for us to be able to formulate it. It's not so much a question of formulating it as there being a fact of the matter that makes it true that we are using the same technique, i.e. that the technique is working.
The basic phenomenon is communicating, isn't it? I mean, whether two people communicate or not. I mean, I was suggesting that the explanation of that phenomenon is that they're using the same technique, although if you try to specify what the technique was, what problems would arise. And you're saying that, are you saying that there's not a valid inference from people communicating to using the same technique?
Yes. It may seem that we're communicating without it being the case. So how do we...
What better explanation would there be?
information could be,
yeah.
That we're communicating, but that we share the same technique?
Yeah.
We are not communicating. We think we're communicating, it looks like we're communicating, but in fact, we're not. Because we don't mean the same things by our words.
So communication is an illusion.
Yes. Well, what in this view allows us to say that communication is not an illusion?
But we are really raising the question, where do you start in an inquiry like this? I assume that what one starts with the phenomenon of people reaching agreement. I mean just behaviorally. And getting along. But you're saying that that may not be a genuine agreement, but the agreement may be an illusion. But that seems to be very like classical, skeptical arguments, isn't it? You take a perfectly normal case where things are going well, and if it allows whether it really is going well. And I don't know, I mean, that way of treating simple case takes you outside the boundary of any ordinary discussion of it, doesn't it? If apparent agreement between two people isn't real agreement, what is real agreement?
I am wondering if one could say that the linguistic formulation of a technique can be understood only extensionally, the technique should be identified with the applications communally taken over as correct. For example, if I say, what do you mean by adding to? I could answer obtaining three from one and four from two and so forth.
Is that the view that I'm expressing, your husband?
Pardon?
Sorry, what is the question?
The question is, I am wondering if one could say that the linguistic formulation of technique, as a consequence of your arguments, should be understood only extensionally, in the sense that I tried to explain.
No, I don't think it is to that.
Okay.